This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Allegory and reality, myth and truth, fact and fiction seem to be interchangeable commodities in the tale Xiang Lu creates in his latest novel, Ghost Cities. So, Xiang, welcome back to 3CR.
Hello, David.
There are two narrative threads that weave their way through this novel, a mythic China and a modern-day reality. Briefly, if you can, and that's a lot to ask, the emperor of the Jin dynasty, Lu Huangdu, is a jealous and paranoid ruler. And what does he construct?
He constructs a labyrinth at the heart of the imperial palace.
And basically there are rules, restrictions, all sorts of things that make that labyrinth rather confusing.
Yes, I mean, it's all tied into art and art's importance. So there is a creator of the labyrinth who is named in the book only as the artisan. The emperor doesn't care how the labyrinth is created, only that it is. And so he's really given this artist free rein, and that's kind of a strange and scary thing for an artist, to be given free rein, but to create this labyrinth really in any way that he wishes. And the way that this artisan wishes is to create this labyrinth in his own image. And so he really patterns the labyrinth according to his memories, his senses, his emotions. Everything that caused him to become him has somehow become part of the labyrinth.
But what does this do to the emperor? His jealousies, his paranoia, then, mean what does he do to the artisan?
Well, he does commit to executing the artisan. He commissions the artisan, before the artisan creates this labyrinth, he does create commission the artisan to create this grand wall sculpture of heavenly scope. And the artisan is able to do it because he is, in fact, if not a great artist, then on his way to becoming one. Yet the emperor's vision and his approach is not been to commission something of greatness, but to destroy greatness. And so there's, I won't reveal all of it, but there's a bit of a stealthily subversive act that the artisan commits, which causes the emperor to A, be completely bowled over and impressed, and B, also be, rendered furious. And so it's this act that really impresses him and causes the emperor to say, you know what, let's get this guy to build a labyrinth for me, then I'll kill him.
But also to destroy that beauty, and that destruction then is also, or the imperfection, is what the emperor wants to see. You can't have anything more perfect than the emperor.
Correct.
So he's got to destroy perfection, got to destroy art. Mm. So there's this sort of, well, I was going to say yin and yang here, of wanting something but simultaneously wanting to get rid of it.
Yeah.
And this then comes out in the world of reality, which we get into, which gets us back to the basic storyline of Xiang Lu, one of the central characters here. And he's been fired from his job. But why?
Well, he starts the book working at the Chinese Sydney Consulate as a translator. But yes, as you mentioned, is fired for the reason that, in fact, he's monolingual and has been relying on Google Translate to do all of his job.
But whose fault is it that he got the job in the first place?
You know what? I thought you were going to ask whose fault was it, and I felt this strange hit of cultural shame because I was about to say mine, that it was my fault, and he's not me, although he shares some similarities and almost the same name. And there is a really strong sort of link of cultural shame there as well. So I guess to answer another question, it's perhaps his fault that he's in this predicament as a bad Chinese, and we can talk about that soon, for not really doing the work, not really putting in culturally to learn his mother tongue.
But a lot of people would find themselves in this position today, crossing continents and countries and not knowing their so-called mother tongue, except is there such a thing in today's age? But also I was thinking also of the consulate members that only interviewed him in English, so they've only got themselves to blame in some ways. But Baby Bao is another character we come across who takes advantage of this situation, because he is actually a film director, amongst other things, and under the hashtag Bad Chinese, capitalises on the flaws in Xiang Lu's conduct or attempt to pass himself off as something he is not. So let's get on to Baby Bao as well. What has Baby Bao done, both as a director and then in creating a set, so to speak, of the world?
Yeah, so it's actually, you know, an allusion to the title Ghost Cities in this modern-day thread of the narrative. Baby Bao, much like the emperor of the ancient narrative, has actually somehow and unexplained taken over a ghost city and essentially turned one of these ghost cities. And I suppose we should talk about ghost cities for some of your listeners who might not be familiar, but he's really taken one of these ghost cities in China and essentially turned it into a giant film set. And so quickly to talk about the phenomenon of ghost cities, these are these cities that have been created in, I'd say, the last 10 or 20 years. They're rather modern, relatively. And, you know, they are full and functioning cities. They've got apartments, apartment buildings, highways, fully functional electricity grids and water, and completely built from the ground up, all with the intention of having people come to live in these cities only for various reasons, for no one or not enough people to come and live in them. And so they, to me, were really these almost art objects of, you know, modern ruins. They seem to be a paradox, completely modern, but also designed to be a ruin in some ways.
Well, there are some ghost cities that are completely empty, that have never been finished, but they're a fabrication to fulfill somebody else's dream, be it a financial dream or a dream of empire. But in many ways, Baby Bao has taken this over as a film set, but he makes bad films. Just because something is indistinguishable from bad art does not mean it is bad art. So he's capitalising on the problems. What are Baby Bao's films like?
They are, you wouldn't want to pay for them, let's put it that way. I think they are, he's probably a true artist in that sense, but he's also a tyrant. He's got very specific views about art, and they're not quite the norm. I think, as you mentioned, this is a quote from Baby Bao, which is, it is not necessarily bad art, even if indistinguishable. What he's intended to do is really create these films and introduce things that are just wrong and use the, I don't know if it's quite language of cinema, but like, for example, you know, he might film an ancient wuxia epic and sort of in, maybe in, I was going to say the background, but perhaps even in the foreground, might have an ancient wuxia warrior have an iPhone in his pocket. So to him, those are anachronisms. That was the word I was searching for. To him, these anachronisms are not actually any evidence of fault or failure. They're the point itself. He's there to create art, but also ruin it in some way.
But also then to create a different reality. And his films are popular because people pay to see them, but these are the people that occupy the ghost city he has used to, and he's brought these people in to act for the purpose of the film, and therefore his films are doing really well because people are buying tickets. It's this convoluted cycle.
It's sort of the, and this was very intentional, the mixing of reality and simulation. What's real and what isn't?
Well, now we get onto some interesting questions, because this doesn't just apply to these ghost cities. It applies to our own reality that we're experiencing today. At one point, I've always thought of great literature as a myth. So the stories we create, in the mythic tale that you've got running parallel, the authors, they reluctantly admitted to having been authors once, but each man had forgotten his name and who had written what. So our literature becomes a fabrication of what we think is important. Is that a message that you're imparting or not?
I think I'd probably glom on more to what you said first, which is that you tend to see literature as myth. And that's something that I've written itself into the book as well. So it's something that we share in terms of how we view literature. I'm talking about things, works like Ulysses, you know, Moby Dick. And I was in particular very influenced and taken by this concept of myth and truth. Looking at John Milton's Paradise Lost, in fact, which is a huge influence on this book. It's a strange book to invoke as an influence, but I'll tell you a little story about a time that many, many years ago, my partner and I were actually in China. We were there for a holiday. I was quite desperate to get out to go and see a ghost city, but unfortunately, our schedule just couldn't accommodate it. I did, however, find, and I've forgotten the name, unfortunately, but I did find word of this abandoned theme park that was at the edges of Beijing, where we were at the time, and there was just enough time for us to manage a trip out. It was very far. Chinese cities are massive. We took a taxi out to it, and the taxi driver was quite confused because she didn't normally go out there. She didn't know why we would go out there. I, much like the character of Ghost Cities, Xiang Lu, am monolingual. So I relied then and still now on my partner to translate. And she asked us why we would go out there. And we explained that, well, there's this abandoned theme park. It had actually become stealthily a bit of a Western tourist hotspot. We finally got out there, and she parked and waited for us. We paid her to wait for us because it was just so remote that we couldn't have flagged a taxi back. And we started exploring these ruins, and they were fascinating to me. Picture Disneyland, not quite as big, but completely rendered in ruins. And in the distance, we actually saw quite a few people exploring these ruins, and they were all Westerners. And so we spent some time there, I think probably an hour or so, taking photos and just marveling at the place. And on our way back, got back to the taxi, and the taxi driver had taken some time to actually explore as well. She didn't know this place existed. She was shocked that we knew. And I think that really spoke to her in some ways, that these Westerners seem to know more about, and of course that's completely untrue, it's just one tiny aspect, but more about, you know, her own hometown than she did. And, you know, she too was marveling at the place. One other thing that I'll mention is that it was quite incredible being there on the ground and exploring these abandoned buildings and what we found. And quite like ghost cities themselves, they're often built in completely rural territories, and the villagers who inhabit those territories get displaced. They don't actually move away. They stay on the land, but they're no longer farmers. They become workers in the city. And so coming back to that thought that you mentioned about actors and, you know, chef actors and bus driver actors, these are really villagers who have to act in different capacities. And what we found in this abandoned theme park, which I found completely fascinating, was that they had never stopped being farmers. They were there ostensibly to be ticket operators. They hadn't been there for, I suppose, years. It was really in ruins. But there was, we didn't see any villagers there, but there was evidence of them. It was obvious that they lived there still. How do I know that? They were still building crops just behind the buildings.
It speaks to this notion of folly. In English society, it's one building. Today, the follies are whole city complexes that could fall into ruin. Is that the sort of philosophical message you're getting across here?
I think art rendered grand in scope is somehow terrifying. The stakes are bigger, and I think if we're talking about folly, I wouldn't frame it as such, not necessarily. So it's really important to point out that, for example, if I'm not mistaken, the Shanghai Pudong area, which I believe now houses the actual airport of Shanghai, the official airport, and is a very populous part of Shanghai, began as a ghost city. It began life as a ghost city. So not, you know, probably using the wrong term, but there are two characters in the book that talk about the difference between a Western view of a ghost city, and it is an object of fascination for us, myself included. But I think perhaps the reason why people from China might not think of it as much of a phenomenon is that, like these characters say, China's immense. I mean, you know, Shanghai has more people in it than all of Australia itself. And so the town planning has got to look a little different. So it's just about balancing and being curious as to both perspectives, the Western perspective, which is what I come from naturally, but just thinking about it from the Chinese one as well.
But both those perspectives, I mean, you've got that mythic narrative going through, and we'll come back to that as well, and the reality that's taking place, and they both seem to be similar in terms of the conceptualization leading to folly in that regard and downfall, and you've applied it to every level. So you've applied it physically to the cities, but then to the literature. But you even go into words themselves. So why do we have the words we have? So at one point you're talking about the fact that the opposite of remember shouldn't be forget. It should be dismember. It would make more logical sense. So our own language is a fabrication, or the English language is a fabrication.
Definitely. And I think it's anyone can play with words. I think there is perhaps more power in having someone whose first language is not English to sort of interrogate and analyze the language itself. I was recently reading Viet Thanh Nguyen's memoir, and that too has a repeated refrain of the, you know, indicating that actually truly the antonym of remember is dismember. And so, you know, listeners, don't think that I've plagiarized from Viet Thanh Nguyen, although I am perhaps flattered if someone does think so. I think anyone who sort of approaches language in this curious and perhaps over analytical fashion is bound to find such beauties and mysteries in the language.
Well, yes, the English language is full of anomalies and craziness. And, you know, we have ruthless, but Ruth has gone by the by. But, okay, you've got the six levels of hell. Here we go, back into the mythic. And I want to raise this because I'm curious, but someone has come up from the sixth level to the first, made his way through all of these levels because they are sort of several layers of punishment as we go down each more, the more worse than the other, but he's escaped. Ministers, once I knew you to be wise, but it appears it is no longer so. This lottery is a fine distraction indeed, something to occupy your thoughts while the true question remains unanswered. Amidst your petty squabbles, did you think to ask yourselves what fate has found us here in exile? Were we not true and loyal? Why then did our emperor cast us out? Long have I pondered on this mystery, and now at last the answer do I hold. He had no reason, but that he feared us. So he's come to the first level, sees all these wise men who are inept in many ways. So why are they occupying that position? So again, this notion of folly in terms of creating a reality for which there is no logic. But you've also told this tale in iambic pentameter. Why?
Well, before I get into that, I want to praise you for your delivery. It's honestly is a dream come true to have someone read your works back to you, especially works that, and this is part of the answer, have been designed to be read aloud. That's part of the reason iambic pentameter is just so lovely. It is probably the basis for theatrical oration. I mentioned John Milton, I mentioned Paradise Lost, and this is perhaps the most Paradise Lostian, you know, part of this epic poem, The Six Levels of Hell. It is very much influenced not only in the iambic pentameter, but this concept of power, autocracy, rising to the level, and using the power of oration to actually convince these ministers to let him up. So I might ramble for a while, but the idea about this particular character who has been imprisoned on these six levels of hell, on the sixth, the lowest level of hell, and his long and slow and torturous, but also empowering journey, I think, of escaping each level. Part of what I wanted to achieve was that it would simply be boring if his level of escape from each floor, if each level of hell was the same. If he sort of pickpocketed a key or, you know, overpowered a guard, there would just be no point to it. And so it's sort of his ascendance. He ascends from hell and back into the living in order to enact his vengeful fantasies. And so on each level acquires new skills and makes good use of them to ascend continually. And so on that level, he makes good use of oration. On other levels, he is a storyteller. On other levels, he is a vicious strategist. On other levels, he creates wonderful works of art. And so I think if I go back to John Milton very quickly, I was actually reading Paradise Lost while I was in China, that time that we went to these theme parks. I'd read it before, tried to read it before, it didn't stick. And the second time was really, I got hooked. And I think the reason I got hooked was I realized this book is designed to be read aloud. It is designed for you to murmur your lips as you read it and intone it. And this really wonderful thing happened to me while I was reading this in the airports and hotels in China, was I came across this part where the tempter, the devil, takes the second Adam, Christ, up to the highest mountain. And he says, here, survey all of these lands. They will all be yours if you just come to my side. Come to the dark side. And Milton is a noted geographer. So there's this very long list, this long sort of winding passage where Milton essentially lists all of the countries, all of the great nations that will be the second Adams, that will come unto him. And interestingly, he actually counts China twice. First as Cathay, and then a little bit later as Paquin, which is the ancient term for Peking, which is the ancient term for Beijing. And so this question sort of nagged at me for a really long time. And I don't think it ought to have, with the right lens. Simply, I think Occam's razor tells us that Milton made a mistake. There was an error and it got introduced and there it is in the final book. But this other part of me was really overtaken by this idea of, well, what if there are two Chinas? What if there are two Chinas, one the mythical one and one the real one? And that's really what got me started on this whole journey.
But this is the whole book in many ways. Even the world we're living in today Is it the real one, a fabricated one, the power of our own imagination imposing our reality on others? We've seen that in political circles, but it extends to the literature. It extends to the art. Maybe the only way we know that something is a reality is the flaws that are in it, the imperfections. So perfection is not something we should aim for. We have well and truly run out of time. But to read this book is to delve into different realities, different times, different styles. And it's absolutely fascinating, and it touches on our own reality today. The book is Ghost Cities, the author Xiang Lu, and it is a University of Queensland Press. So thank you very much for coming in and talking with me today.
Thank you. It's been my absolute pleasure.